Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For nearly 60 years, economist Alice Rivlin was a key player in national economic and social policymaking. She was a founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, served as director of Office of Management and Budget, and was vice chair of the Federal Reserve, and served in the Johnson, Clinton, and Obama administrations. When not in government, she was a senior fellow in economics at the Brookings Institution. As she approached the end of her life, and she died in 2019, she was increasingly alarmed by the partisan warfare and gridlock that stymied both political parties and decided to address the need for bipartisanship and consensus building in our contemporary politics. And she used the events she witnessed as a policymaker on why finding consensus delivers better legislation and solutions for conservatives and progressives alike. Her book, Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters, mixes scholarship and memoir on how to make Washington work for all of us. Sadly, it was unfinished at her death, but she had dictated an outline and themes for completing the book, which was taken up by her son, Alan, and daughter-in-law, Sherry. Alan joins us today. He's a veteran pollster and served in the Clinton administration as a senior advisor to Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala. The book is titled Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters. Alan Rivlin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
You know, your mother passed away in May of 2019, before January 6th, before the pandemic, before the racial reckoning we saw after George Floyd. But she addresses a lot of these themes in the book that you co-authored with her, her final book, Divided We Fall. How important was it to Alice Rivlin to finish this book about finding political consensus?
First of all, I want to thank you for being here. And I'm also joined by my wife, Sherry Rivlin, who's the third co-author on this book. But Alice Rivlin, she did pass away in 2019, but she passed away with a kind of heavy heart and with a great deal of concern about American politics and the way things were going. And she was experiencing gridlock and stalemate. And she was, of course, a member of both of the commissions trying to find a solution to our massive federal deficit when Barack Obama was president. There were two commissions and she was on both of them, but neither of them were able to see a grand bargain succeed to reduce control spending and raise enough revenue to get us on a sustainable budget path. And I think that led to her feeling that the problem with America was not that the economy was broken, but our politics was broken. And she had a sort of urgent message she wanted to deliver that if we don't stop the blaming and start solving problems, the public is losing confidence in our government to solve problems, and that's going to lead to something bad. She starts the book with the words that she fears that the American experiment is in danger of failing. And she did not see that over the period of time after she died, that these things would become more apparent to more of us. But she knew for the last year of her life, she died of lung cancer in 2019, that she wasn't going to get this book finished. And she started working with Sherry and me and her husband, Sid Winter. And we would just sit around the fire talking about how bad things were. And she was writing how she traced this. This is not a Trump thing. This is a long decline into dysfunctional politics. And she really gave us at least half a book and a complete vision for a book that we then completed for her as so much history was happening, but the history all just made her understanding of what was going on more prescient. And the most important thing about the book, I think, is that it ends with, so if you're concerned about democracy, what can you do about it? And she has about two dozen suggestions at the end of the book. So it took us a long time, but we knew we needed to complete this and get her final thoughts out there.
Do you think she would have been surprised by the events of the last 3 years that have occurred since her passing? because there's so many sections in the book that sort of give us a sense that she was thinking along these lines.
You know, in some sense, I don't think she'd be surprised, but you can't really say that because so much of what happened was beyond anyone's imagination. So let me take both sides of that. We wrote an introduction, or sorry, it was a foreword and an afterword that allowed us to sort of put the book into context and express how we feel she would have responded to what happened. And we say, you know, she would not have needed to say, we need to resolve our political differences through reason and discourse and persuasion, not by violence. She did not imagine that we would have a violent insurrection at the Capitol. And, you know, she taught me those values before I went to nursery school. That was basic. So in that sense, I don't think she foresaw, but she could really see the decline in public trust for institutions, the rise in a sort of populist sense that the experts don't know what they're doing. So we've got to take our government back. She was the expert's expert. She was a real Washington insider who believed in nonpartisan policy analysis. She founded the Congressional Budget Office. And all of the sort of guardrails of democracy, the institutions that we have to try to figure out whether climate change is going on or not, and to solve our public health challenges, and all of those were under assault at the time of her life. She lived through part of the Trump administration. She knew Donald Trump, but she didn't see the full-on assault on the guardrails of democracy that we've all now seen.
Now, the book sort of appears to see America on a point of a fulcrum, if you will, given the dysfunction of federal governance so much of the time. And I have to say, not all the time, but certainly that is the that sort of dysfunction sort of charges the air and what we see from Washington. And so one side was we have to change course, try to find consensus on policies that divide us, and quit using those problems as a political cudgel to seek a short-term partisan advantage. Or, she writes, we could blow it. I believe those are her words. And it's basically stay on our current path where we're dividing, you know, rural versus urban, progressive versus conservative, Republican versus Democrat. And we do completely lose faith in our institutions, which I think a good segment of the population already has lost that. You're right that she was an optimist. Did she feel like we could change course?
Rich, I really think you're reading the book exactly right. And that is, she was balanced on a fulcrum. She was alarmed, but she was optimistic. And she quotes Bill Clinton, whom she worked for. She was his budget director for a time. And one of his most famous statements, there's nothing wrong with America that can't be cured by what's right with America. And she always believed that there were many bipartisan solutions that were easily within grasp if we could just put the blaming aside, stop thinking about the next election, and start thinking about the people who were elected in the last election getting things done for the American people. And there's a long section on the political science behind America's decline and where we end up. And when I say we, I mean the three of us authors, because that's who wrote the book. But where we end up is bipartisanship happens a lot. It happens all of the time, much more than people think, but far less than we need. And the balance there is most of the bills that pass government are bipartisan. The ones the press focuses on most are the stalemates and the ones that get stuck in a partisan standoff, or sometimes in a Democrats-only standoff or a Republicans-only standoff. But the press covers the conflict, not the cooperation. And so bipartisanship does happen. It happens much more than people think, but it happens less than we need because so many problems are getting stalled in bipartisan standoffs. We just haven't been able to come up with a comprehensive immigration reform. We haven't been able to do the grand bargain to get our deficits and debt under control. Climate change is going unaddressed, even though there's an international agreement for how we would move forward on it. Those were the things that frustrated her, but she really believed if Americans got involved and saved the politicians from themselves, is one of her phrases, we could really get ourselves on another path. And I think even after January 6th, she would maintain that kind of optimistic approach to the problems we have now.
My guest today is Alan Rivlin. He's co-author, along with Sherry Rivlin, of his mother's final book. It's called Divided We Fall. They helped finish her final book. It's called Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters. And interesting, after we talk about this fulcrum point and finding consensus, she writes that there is a place for partisanship, but it's something that partisans do. We actually need partisanship, but we also need to find bipartisan solutions. That seems at odds with each other. How do the two work hand in glove?
First of all, Alice Rivlin was a partisan Democrat. She served in two Democratic administrations. And someone can read this book and find criticism of Republicans, some criticism of Democrats, but probably on balance, she's more critical of Republicans than Democrats. And then they say, this isn't a bipartisan book. It's not. She would say, it's not a bipartisan book. It's a book by a partisan Democrat calling for more bipartisanship to get our problems solved. And what does that mean? Well, bipartisanship doesn't mean you have to be a moderate. It doesn't mean you don't have any values. It means that the Democrats have progressive values and the Republicans have conservative values, and yet they do what the founding fathers wanted them to do. They find the common ground, they hammer out solutions that are acceptable to both sides, and they move them forward. And we do this all the time. We did it on the COVID relief bills. They were massive. Bipartisanship happened during the Trump administration. It happened during the Biden administration, and it happened. It has been happening for all presidents. So partisanship is important. Voters need to have a choice, and people who are for smaller government that provides less services know that the Republican Party represents them, and people who are for more government services to help more people know the Democratic Party is where they are, and they can vote on that. They about cancel each other out. But people who believe in lower taxes don't have to fight to eliminate every revenue increase and every loophole closing. And people who believe in more government services don't have to hold the position that you can't solve one set of problems without promising to solve all of the problems that we have. Both sides have to learn to accept compromise solutions, get half a loaf, but at least that's bread for the American people. We're solving problems and moving forward. So that's, I think, how we reconcile the idea that bipartisanship is something partisans do, and they need to do it more often and frankly, with a lower degree of blame and trying to get the other side to look bad in the next election.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And there was another point she made, was that when you look at the laws that have been passed by one party only, whether it's put through on reconciliation or certainly in the early part of the Obama administration, they really had just about the votes to get through a Senate. They had 60 senators. And it says, when you look at that legislation, oftentimes, the party faithful is still disappointed by the end result, because getting consensus even within a party is sometimes as difficult as reaching out to the other side and gathering votes from the other side who are willing to compromise. And so what you see is, when you embark on that hyper-partisan, at least this is what the book seemed to argue to me, is that when you embark on this hyper-partisan path, generally you're not happy with the results.
I think that's absolutely right. And what she says is, it's not partisanship that's the problem. It's uncompromising partisanship. Mm. And we've had a development in our politics that really started in the 80s, where there were organizations, special interest organizations, ones that gave the public a voice in their government for abortion, against abortion, on the issue of gun rights, on the issue of taxation in particular, with the no, read my lips, no new taxes pledge from the American Taxpayers Union, that take positions that if you give them one inch, one penny less in spending or one penny more in revenue increases, that we're going to call you out in the next election. And that carries forward for all of this. And we end up with uncompromising partisans. And compromise has become a dirty word among political activists on both sides of the political aisle. And the book relies heavily on the political science research of Francis Lee of Princeton University and James Curry. And they analyzed all the votes in Congress and found out that most of the ones that pass do pass with bipartisanship, but the bipartisan path is very difficult. But they also say the partisan path, the Democrats only or Republicans only path, is very difficult. And we've seen that play out over and over again. She was in the Clinton administration, and in the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, his economic bill got completely stalled in a standoff between progressives in the, mostly in the House, and moderates mostly in the Senate. Obama had the same thing. He had both chambers of Congress. His bills got stalled the same way, the fight over a public option. The progressives wanted it in the House. It was blocked by moderate Democrat senators in the Senate. And both of those presidents appeared weak because they couldn't get their party together to pass legislation. They both were able to pass things, but they took much longer than we had, and there was a big battle on the Democratic side in both cases. Well, it looked like Biden was headed down the same path. And this is, of course, after Alice's death, but we talk about it in the afterword. That he tried to follow two paths, a bipartisan path that got a lot of things done, the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act, the help for veterans who had lung disease from being near burn pits, and there are others, the expansion of NATO following the Ukraine war. There was also a partisan path, the Democrats-only path, that found real roadblocks and got stalled, and Biden's approval numbers were headed down. Eventually, in August, they reached a deal to pass parts of the Build Back Better, calling it the Inflation Reduction Act. And the only question is, did they do that in time? Did the Democrats do that in time to save themselves in the upcoming election? And the jury is still out, and the jury is the American voting public. But I think what we learned from this period is, at least during these 2 years, the first 2 years of the Biden administration, 60 out of 100 senators is an easier bar to clear than 50 out of 50 Democratic senators. Yeah. And so both paths were difficult. Eventually, they achieved success on both paths, but it did take a long time.
My guest today is Alan Rivlin. He's co-author, along with his wife, Sherry Rivlin, of Alice Rivlin's final book. She was, of course, the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. She served as the director of Office of Management and Budget and was a vice chair of the Federal Reserve. And their final book is titled Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. This book does call for substantive change in Congress. For example, ending the filibuster, ending the Hastert rule, which is not really a rule, but it's followed in Republican-led House of Representatives, that basically any legislation has to find a majority from the majority party. If they have to go across the party lines, they're not going to bring it to the floor. How would these changes affect this idea of finding consensus?
In some sense, they'd make a big difference. In some sense, they wouldn't make that big of a difference. What we learned in looking at all of this in detail is that the rules in the House and Senate can block agreement they're very effective at blocking agreement, in particular the filibuster, but there's lots of ways that the majority can keep a bill from getting to the floor. And one of them was the Hastert rule, which is, as you say, not a rule, but it was a guideline. And it wasn't followed all the time, but it started with Dennis Hastert, and then John Boehner used it often to block. And it really is designed to block bipartisanship. It's designed to keep control of the House by making it difficult for bipartisan bills to get to the floor. Nancy Pelosi followed a different path. They had rules that made it easier for bipartisan bills to get to the floor. And that has changed things. You know, the Problem Solvers Caucus created a process that made it easier to get the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Act, the replacement for NAFTA, through, and that kind of thing. But what we really figured out is it doesn't change that much. What you really need is the will, because where there's the will, there's the way. When the Democrats and Republicans reach agreement on a bill, the rules are not going to stand in the way. They're going to be able to pass them anyway. So in large measure, what we really need is a change in attitude among the leadership that says getting things done for the American people is more important than scoring points in the next election.
Earlier, we were talking about this idea that the public must save politicians from themselves. What does that mean?
It means that there really is a lot of opportunities for the public to be involved in this government, for good or ill. The people who are most involved in the government join special interest groups. They get together. They learn how to hold press conferences. They learn how to use the direct mail and the internet to raise funds. They learn how to frame issues in ways that make it harder for politicians to compromise. The activists raise their voice in our American process, and they do it in a way that makes our politics more partisan, more uncompromising. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is the First Amendment. This is people using their constitutional rights to petition their government. The people with the very strong views are farther to the left and farther to the right than most Americans. That's why they do this. And they make it so that the voices of people who really, the majority of people who just like to see government get more done, are less in the process. So the way people can get involved, first of all, is vote. They can vote for candidates that talk about working across the aisle and getting things done. There are a lot of them out there. And they can join organizations like No Labels, like the National Institute for Civil Discourse, the Common Cause, the League of Women Voters, that are designed to give people a voice in making democracy better, making our politics, getting the money out of politics, getting the politics out of redistricting, figuring out how to make it easier for people to vote, you know, wherever they live. The idea is join with other people who care about democracy and saving democracy as much as you do, and make your voice heard in that way.
Now, this book, Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters, also sort of outlines Alice Rivlin's role in government over the last 30 years, what she experienced. And in our final couple of minutes, I know she had a mea culpa looking at her own work as far as realizing the dimension of income and racial equality and how we're now seeing varying economic prospects, oftentimes based on geography and, you know, economic class. She also wrote about not anticipating the 2008 financial crisis and also that effect that you mentioned just a moment ago of money on politics and public policy. Can you talk about what she felt like she had learned and what lessons she had learned from her time in government?
Rich, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to that, because that really was what was on her mind at the very end. And that section of the book was dictated to myself and Sherry, and also my nephew, Caleb Jones, who was there with us. What she was trying to say was she really did think that the decline in faith in the institutions of government was somewhat deserved. She felt herself to be part of a group of people who were, you call them the economic class in Washington, the economic professionals, and they work in all levels of, all branches of government, and they trade jobs. They do, they, like Alice, have many different jobs looking out for the economy, but they didn't notice what was going on before the financial crisis, and everybody missed it. And she was essentially apologizing for that, but she was also saying, we have to realize that we speak with less authority now because we missed it, and it hurt so many people. And the response to that crisis actually increased economic inequality. The markets were saved, and the wealthy did very well after the financial crisis, but the struggling Americans really were hit hard. They lost their homes, they lost their jobs, and just as they were starting to come, and they started to come back in the big cities on the coasts first, but there were vast stretches of America in the middle that really never got out of the recession that was caused by the financial crisis. And then we're hit with a pandemic 10 years later, more than that, and the same thing happens. We save the financial markets. The wealthy do very well in the pandemic, but the rest of America doesn't, and it increases our economic inequality problem, which really is the biggest problem we have right now. Inflation is bad, but it hits the people at the bottom much harder than it hits the people at the top. If we have a slowing economy, which looks like we will, it's going to hit the people at the bottom more than the top. The real problem is inequality. And she does talk about the geographic dimension of inequality. There are parts of America, both in our inner cities, but also in the small towns and rural counties across America, that need more help than the people who own high tech or work in high tech companies. And so I think that's really the agenda that she would have for us moving forward.
It's a very interesting book. It's titled Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters. Alan Rivlin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Alan Rivlin is a veteran Washington pollster and the son of the longtime economic policymaker, the late Alice Rivlin. Alan and his wife, Sherry, helped Alice Rivlin finish her final book, which is published posthumously, titled Divided We Fall, Why Consensus Matters. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.